I am Suzanne Lang with KRCB's A Novel Idea. The Guest Book is Sarah Blake's best-selling, sweeping family saga that spans three generations, and I had the pleasure of speaking with her about it from her home in Washington, D.C. We'll listen to that conversation in just a minute. For lovers of the short story, we'll revisit Laurie Ann Doyle, whose book World Gone Missing contains 12 emotionally compelling stories set in Northern California that touch on loss, love, and connection. It's a novel idea. The Guest Book is Sarah Blake's historical fiction centering around a white, East Coast family of wealth, and opens during the Depression when most others are suffering its effects. The multi-generational story opens with a family tragedy that sets in motion an emotional warping that ripples into the present day. The book weaves in racism, homophobia, anti-Semitism, Nazis, white privilege, along with the intricate family dynamic that many experience, and it also contains a steamy love story and beautiful prose. Sarah's previous books include Grange House and The Postmistress. Let's listen to our conversation. Welcome, Sarah Blake. So happy to talk to you today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we're here to talk about your, what I believe is maybe your third novel.
That's right.
The Guest Book. Sarah, describing this book is really something. It's a what we might call an epic family saga, multi-generational story. And it's not what I would call a historical fiction, but it certainly spans the entire 20th century and has enough historical details that as a reader, there are times that it's that history that pulls you in, and at other times it's the relationships and the family drama that pulls you in. So I want to start with, how did this all steep with you to get this rich narrative brew?
Oh, well, thank you. I mean, one of the things that it is hard to describe this novel, and I think in part because it steeped for a long time and it came, it took a long time to sort of come together. When I finished The Postmistress in 2009, I knew that I wanted to write a big, juicy, you know, family, multi-generational novel. And it was also, I wanted to have this big saga in some way be a kind of prism, the way that a family can be a prism for a kind of country's story, the way that Isabel Allende's, you know, House of Spirits or Wolf's The Years or the Foresight Saga. Like, I very much wanted to just sort of tackle a family and a country and you know, thinking about history and family histories and in that way. So it was already going to be a big mush of lots and lots of things. But at the time in particular, I don't know if you remember, but in 2008, the candidate Obama at that point had sort of directly addressed the fact that an African-American running for office was going to be asking the country to sort of directly look at the way in which the racial past was cueing the present. And, you know, he quoted William Faulkner and said, the past isn't dead, it isn't even past. And I remember at the time feeling like, you know, as a white person, that this was this fantastic sort of call to arms and a real inspiration, because it was sort of breaking the silence around race that I felt I'd grown up in. And I really wanted to enter. I wanted whatever I was going to write to enter that conversation, because it seemed like it was opening up. So that those were the sort of initial sort of early percolations. But then as usual, I just start to write, and I knew that I wanted to move back and forth in time, because it seems to me that the idea of having the ways in which we echo and repeat our parents and grandparents without oftentimes not knowing what we're doing. I wanted to somehow literalize that in the plot of my novel, so that the sort of voices of three generations were always kind of in play. And that turns out to be quite hard to do. So it took a while. But those were the sort of ambitions and the roadmap.
Yes, it is amazing that from the reader's perspective, you do have these multiple storylines. Because they're individuals, and individuals have their own stories in life, but where one generation doesn't necessarily, you don't know, she doesn't know what her grandmother was thinking or what her mother's experience was. And I just found that all very, it drew me in on each level. And then to have these historical elements that really resonate with our current moment, I just found really a compelling part of the book, too. And so I'm sure it was tricky stuff for you to pull that all together. But let's, for our readers and listeners, let's set up the kind of the frame of the story for them.
I would say the guest book is about three generations of an old money family that has run out of its money, but not its place, which is an island off the coast of Maine, or sort of more importantly, its sense of its place. And it moves back and forth between the 30s, the 50s, and the present as the consequences of a single night or a single moment in 1936 play on, carry down through the generations without being told. So the we know, the reader, sees the thing that in some ways the secret or the memory that passes on and is unconfronted. And so we watch the ripple effect of those consequences through the generations and see, in some senses, it's asking the question of, what does memory look like? What does unconfronted memory look like? And how do we see that? How do we see generations sort of repeat because they don't know? And so they're carrying the history of a moment forward. And so in that way, it was the way in which a family and then this country, sort of the sort of half-truths of what we remember and what we forget, how they start to speak to, I agree with you very much, with where we are now in this country as we try, and especially the white collective imagination tries to, sort of open its eyes, and I believe is starting to see more and more that the continuum, the through line between past and present really has been uninterrupted, for years, and that this seems to be shifting. And the book very much is asking us to look at that. Like, what does it look like to come to see what you carry inside you, the history that you carry inside?
Boy, there's just so much to even unpack right there. that the personal, the social, the cultural, and the secrets that even are unwitting secrets that we have within families, and that we think we know our families, and there's so much we don't. And even, there's cousins in the story of the Miltons is the family we're dealing with. And they see things differently than the children do. Mm-hmm. And I think that sort of thing probably resonates on levels with many people. Mm-hmm. But the Miltons are as you said, they start out as a kind of a Eastern blue blood family who is really rising out of the Depression quite well. And they are dealing with commercial enterprise and international commerce. And so then there's this whole kind of Nazi thread that comes through. And even in that storyline, it is something that you don't really... There are a lot of things in the book that one wants some resolution, but doesn't always get it in the way we might anticipate it as the reader. So that, too, I found was interesting choices you made in the fabric of the book as to what was holding our attention at any given point in time. And again, I'm kind of interested in your own process of how you decided to reveal and when you decided to reveal elements of the story.
Well, you know, I don't know if you remember Howard's End, the novel by E.M. Forster, but one of the things, it's an Edwardian novel, and one of the things I love about it, it taught me when I read it long ago, there is a plot twist that comes very early on in the book. One of the characters is given this property, and it's a codicil, and the family reads this little note that the mother who had died writes, saying, "I should like Howard's End to go to so and so." And they look at it and they think, "Well, she must have been out of her mind. Forget it. We're not gonna tell this, you know, this the beneficiary." So, and that's early on in the book. All the way through the book, that secret remains. It's an open secret, and you, the reader, know it. And I remember at the time, I mean, I loved this idea that there is something that we know is not right and is unfair and is just waiting there like a bomb, you know. And will it ever, you know, get revealed? And then, you know, it does, and it gets resolved. And so for me, that, like, one of the things that the great joys of being a novelist is when I see things that, I mean, I want to try, you know. So in many ways, it was that kind of thing that I loved, that I wanted to put into play myself, like that something could, that we, a reader, could see something happen and the characters don't know how it's going to resolve, and that is in part a way to keep the open secret of that's often, you know, what's told and not told and what's remembered, quote unquote, and not, and pass it through, and that in and of itself is then a mechanism, you know, sort of shows who the characters are who repress that memory. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
And who it is, and so anyway, so that was a big kind of hope, is that I could do something like what Forster had done in Howard's End. And then there's above my head, where I'm sitting right now as I'm talking to you, is my bulletin board where all the sort of quotes that I've had all through my writing life. And two quotes that ended up being the epigraphs of this novel, which I've stared at for, you know, years, were above my head. And I realized that the conversation between the two of them was also a way to sort of think about how to write the secrets of this novel. And the first one is James Baldwin's sentence, which comes from an essay in the 50s, where he says, "People are trapped in history, and history is trapped in them." And then Virginia Woolf's quote from, it's something a character says in her very last novel, Between the Acts, and it says, "Surely it was time someone invented a new plot." And so the idea of actually what would it mean to have history inside us? What would that look like? So again, writing the sort of secrets, as you say, the things that I do reveal or don't reveal, but we see what they look like when they're trapped in people, when people don't tell them. But we know the secret. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, we know what the character does in 1936. We see what she is trying to repress. And so we watch the way in which it's not told, and that in and of itself is a way to both tell and withhold at the same time.
Yes. Yes. And the kind of fulcrum of all this activity is an island off the coast of Maine that the Milton family has a summer home on, and it is their family home, and it is also the location of where many of these impressions, conversations, activities have taken place over the course of these three, well, really four generations, but mm-hmm. three generations of people who are really interacting with one another. Mm-hmm. And the island itself is a, you know, the main place that everything takes place in the book. And so creating a kind of this finite space where things happen over time. Is that a place you know? Is that a how did that come about?
So my family does have a place like the Knowltons' place. And I think that these, and you know, my grandparents did buy it in the 30s. And I think in many ways when there are places that are attached to families, and it can be one generation, two or three, but these places that can come to bind and sort of define who you are, you know, because they hold so many layers of your life in them if you do have something like this. So it's a place that I know quite well. I mean, it's not this, I've described it sort of into fiction as well, but the feeling of a house that sort of holds all of you and your voices, in a house that, you know, you can remember having fallen down the stairs when you were four or 10, or you can remember your parents' voices, or you can remember putting your children to bed in the same, you know, bedroom, or that which is, you know, incredibly lucky and amazing if you have such a place. But then such a place demands certain things of you. I mean, it has actually witnessed things that you haven't. So again, I was thinking about the power of places to sort of hold that, you know, places can remember, and their the sort of atmosphere that they hold onto is something that seemed to me to be incredibly generative for fiction. So I sort of used both my attachment to this place, my feelings about it, my ambivalences about it, as well as the sense of the inescapability of your own, you know, the connection, your identity, and this place mm-hmm. that has, you know, been given you.
And you just used the phrase, I think, and history held in a mm-hmm. place. And there were other elements in the story where you mention that, and one of the main characters, a third generation, her name is Evie, and her husband goes off and is doing some research in Europe, in Berlin. I think it was in Berlin or in Germany someplace, where he comes across what he was calling stumble stones that marked the location of where Jews were taken. Mm-hmm. And as an acknowledgement, as a commemoration of this horrible event in history that real lives were involved. And then I don't know if was it one of the characters who suggested that what would that look like then translated into our own national cultural shame of mm-hmm. slavery. And can you talk a little bit more about those thoughts?
Absolutely, yeah. Sort of halfway into the writing of this, so, you know, maybe two or three years in, our family moved to Berlin for a sabbatical. And I had the contours of what I wanted for this novel and how I wanted to be moving in and out of the present and the past, but it was, I think I was sort of really powerfully understood what it would mean, what writing a novel like this means in terms of confronting, how you confront the past, how do you see the relation between past and present. It was powerfully sort of made clear by the stumble stones. And because these are concrete paving stones that an artist, Gunter Demrig, started in the early 90s as a way to, as you say, acknowledge that something happened. Something happened here. And so you are for the past literally interrupts the present. The past, you are literally standing and then reckoning with that the place. Often it's, you know, just the sidewalk outside a building, or since so much of Berlin was bombed, outside the sort of what would have been a building. But the fact that at your feet, the ground beneath your feet, is attesting and is acknowledging something happened. And so part of what it made me understand is that it asks you to think about yourself in that moment. Who would you have been in that place? Because that is the real place where it happened. Would you have been the person taken? Would you have been the person walking by? Would you have looked, or would you have looked away? And so it's a way in which, that because it's at your feet, it demands a reckoning of, you know, who are you now? How are you looking away now? And, you know, one of the things I had thought when I first saw the stumble stones was like, what if there was a stone put down for every place that a slave was sold or resold? Or if we were to bring it now, you know, what if there was a marker for every place, you know, an unarmed man is shot? I mean, just the ways in which these places, what if it was externalized? What if the memory of what if it's acknowledged? What if it, you know, this happened? How would that change our discussion of the relationship between the past and the present? So being in Berlin, which is a city which does not, which is now, you know, just articulates its past over and over on walls and on the streets and the sidewalks, and just being so struck by the fact that I feel like our country, and again, this was 6 years ago, our country has not yet done that kind of public reckoning. And of course, Bryan Stevenson's lynching memorial is all about that, and you know that just opened a year ago. So that, again, so much seems to be changing in terms of the landscape of public reckoning. Anyway, it's all part of that conversation.
And that this is a very white family who are polite, and but the way you bring in their discomfort and judgment on Jews, on Jewish people, and their commerce during the post-depression era here, and which was the emerging Nazi era over there. And there's one of the characters in the book, a German woman, Elsa, who she brings it home, and one of the characters says something like, "We know how to protect our people," and here she brings it up, lynchings that were happening during that same period of time in this country. So I felt that the way you brought that all together really caused me as the reader to reflect on both of those things in a way, the historical, the contemporary, and to realize how much we take for granted, how much we do not acknowledge. And all of this that we're just talking about right now is some of the historical fabric of the story. And then you have the very personal family emotions and the kind of loss and loyalty that happens within families.
And the codes of silence and the codes of deportment that, you know, that are sort of, quote unquote, sort of managing that loss and that love and, you know, what that looks like.
And we can really see, because you've kind of brought all these together, that we cannot really segregate within our own selves the personal from the social and cultural, that it will trip us up.
Yeah, and I think this goes back to the Baldwin, this my understanding of, you know, that history is trapped in us, that the historical self is always a part of us, and that can be, you know, both our family's history, but it's also this the larger cultural history, that this is what we carry inside us. And this is what gets repeated until it's sort of stopped and taken out and looked at, you know? And
yeah.
For me, Baldwin is so, so important as a sort of guide to thinking about how sort of each of our own individual relation to a kind of collective historical past, both racial and in this case as well, anti-Semitic, and class. I mean, I come from this kind of family, the, you know, sort of white, old moneyed, and I really wanted to kind of interrogate the sort of sense I had of the kind of fable and mythos of that kind of what that family has concocted for itself. I really wanted to look at that and how it was inside and what that meant. I mean, I had grown up with what is, you know, this phrase that was sort of very common, but, you know, quote unquote casual anti-Semitism, which I always think is like, what is that? But it's a way to say that, you know, it was sort of okay. It was the acceptable or just, it was like, that's just how it was. And I do have a scene in the book where some, you know, Evie says, well, that's how it was in the 30s. You would say this Jew or that Jew. And her husband, Paul, who she has, this is the last generation, and who is Jewish, looks at her and says, how it was. And, you know, just the sort of pausing and externalizing and saying, look at what, you know, what does that mean to say? And just the ways in which we pass on without stumbling and confronting and saying, listen to what you are saying, because that's how systems perpetuate themselves. That's how codes continue. You know, it was very much something I kind of wanted to understand myself, the sort of anti-Semitism, racism, class, you know, sort of pride that I had absolutely been steeped in. And what does that look like? You know, how is it carried on? And not, you know, in sort of with pyrotechnics and atrocities, you know, but just right. Like this sort of quote unquote, you know, ordinary ways, families, like how do we pass this stuff on? And so why, how is it that the past is not dead? I mean, that's how.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And that we think we have moved beyond it, but really it's only through that ultimate reckoning with our own history that mm-hmm. we can maybe...
And our relation to that history, yeah.
Yes, 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 mm-hmm. yes. Mm-hmm. Well, Sarah Blake, the book is The Guest Book, and I feel like there's so much more we could talk about this, and we haven't really talked much about many of the characters who are all... I feel pretty richly drawn and seeing these family dynamics, but I'm afraid we're running out of time. But I feel like we've talked about really what this book is about beyond the plot points.
Oh, well, it's such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
Sarah Blake and I speaking about her novel, The Guest Book, which is on several top 10 bestseller lists around the country, including the San Francisco Chronicle. Let's take a short break and then visit with Laurie Ann Doyle and the short story.
They stare at me, and I don't know. of opportunity. I just wanna go fishing. I can feel my dreams caving in on me. They're all locked up and you have the key. And I don't know why I can't see the light, but all I wanna be is free. I can see the road as it winds away. I can see the sun bringing a new day. You just stand and wave as I drive away. Darling, something wasn't right with I.
That was Sarah Jackson Holman's Maybe Something's Wrong from her 2010 album When You Dream. I am Suzanne Lang, and this is KRCB's A Novel Idea. Lorianne Doyle's debut collection is World Gone Missing, a slender volume containing a dozen stories of longing, loss, and what goes missing. Let's listen. Lorianne Doyle, welcome to Sonoma County.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're here today to talk about your recently released book, World Gone Missing. It's a book of short stories that I found had an intimacy with the characters that sometimes seemed a little bit close to them sharing an inner life that we all have. But when you are exposed to the inner life of another, sometimes it seems a range of emotions, of melancholy, of sadness, of wondering. So tell me about the writing of these stories and how you get to that place.
Well, one of my favorite things about fiction that I don't think we really have in any other art form is this ability to get deep inside a character's head. And I really love that. So I worked hard to figure out, first of all, how I could do that in a natural way and what really was going on. You know, what was the truth? Not just sort of putting some stereotypical emotion on a character, but actually sharing kind of what's deep inside them, things that they are not admitting to other people. Often I would say, sure. And then the phrase would be, she lied. And I used to love writing that because the contradiction is so real for us. We say all kinds of things to people just to kind of put that word out there and get the conversation, keep the conversation moving, but not necessarily the truth.
Did they evolve over time? Because they seem to range a bit in the kind of relationships that you're exploring there.
Oh, yes. This book took a decade to write. And I'm both sort of proud and chagrined to say that. I'm proud that I put so much energy into it and, you know, just kept going. And I'm also like, wow, a decade of my life. But it was a fruitful decade, I thought. I wrote many more stories that I, you know, put aside that didn't fit. I did a lot of false starts. I also write flash fiction and I write essays, so I did a lot of that. I started and stopped a couple of novels. So there was and I also teach writing. So there was a lot going on, but it was when I had about five or six stories and I began to realize that this missing element was so important. That's when it got really interesting. Because I began to think all the different ways that people can go missing. They can go missing on each other. They can go missing on themselves. And so the collection really became an exploration of that. How, you know, it's not just death. I mean, we do think of death a lot, and about half the stories have to do with someone who's either passed away or is passing away. But then there's also a story about divorce and a story about adoption and a story about a father who abandoned her daughter. There's just, and, you know, people said, well, you have that story about called Girls. And it's like we see this woman at 12, 22, and I think it's 52, but I'm not sure. It might be 51. And so what's the missing element there? And I realize what the missing element is that she's missing. People are looking at this woman at 3 points in her life, and they don't see her. They see what they project on her.
Let's talk about that story, girls. and I think in my notes, in my little crib notes, I say something like my key word was brassieres. And as I was reading that and latching on to that story, somehow it resonated with me just even as a woman. And I'll say the girls, well, I don't think I want to give away what the girls in the story are. So, but
well, we have some literal girls, but right, yes, we right, have some figurative girls
right,
too.
Let's talk more about that story, because she was trying to define herself as a young girl even,
right,
and not being able to, or right, being prevented from doing that. And her big act of assertion was going out and buying her own bra.
Right. Well, ultimately, I think she's a misfit. I mean, her body just doesn't fit any of the typical female shapes that brassieres or underwear, we could say, are made for. So she's in this very strange place of, particularly as a young girl of 12, wanting to fit in, desperately wanting to fit in, wanting to be a girl just like all the other girls, wanting to be in the clique. And her body type just doesn't allow that. And we see that. I thought what was really fun about writing that story was the shop women. They do different things. The first shop woman is very patronizing and very, okay, you know, we'll find just the right thing for you. She's a little sarcastic, and I don't think Mella picks up on it at all. And that's also the wonderful thing about writing, is that you can have your characters kind of clueless sometimes. Yeah, so ultimately, though, they all want to make a sale. And I think by the time we get to – it's a triptych, so we have three parts. By the time we get to the last part, Mella realizes that that's what it's all about. And so I think there's a way that she's really yearning for some kind of acceptance even from herself. And I think she looks back at her young self and kind of wishes that, wow, why did I put myself through all that? I mean, there's a lot of imagery in the last section, which I won't give away too. Yeah, and World Gone Missing, I think the endings are all heavily, you know, I really love imagery. I really love setting. So we find a lot of that coming up at the end, symbolically.
What I found, and I want to ask you about, is that the way some of the stories end is inconclusive, or it's just a moment. We don't know what happens in the next moment. And that sometimes for the reader is stimulating and other times disappointing.
Uh-huh.
And yet it also feels like it underscores the reality of the situation.
Uh-huh.
But as the writer, how do you approach that? And especially in the short story
yeah,
form, like it's time to end and they don't need to know anymore. Or or it's time to end and this is what they need to know.
Uh-huh. Well, I'm a big fan of Anton Chekhov, who is a master of the short story, as everyone probably knows. And he always said, you know, cut off the front part of the story, cut off the last part of the story, and give us the middle. I wasn't that extreme, but my goal in an ending, and I went through many, many endings. Some of these stories, like Voices, that story just landed on me. I kind of had to tinker with the ending. I love the last line. I think it's the perfect last line to end the collection on. I don't think I'm giving anything away if I say it's just the two of us talking, because that's how I see this whole collection, is my talking with the reader, and in a way the reader talking back, although I don't know what the reader's saying, but I'm hoping we're having a conversation. In terms of endings, though, I think what I'm looking for is some kind of wrapping up of the action at hand, and some kind of gesture towards the future. And perhaps that's the inconclusive part, is I want the reader to be able to see what might be coming up next. And so if we take that last line, just the two of us talking, hopefully the reader can envision at some point, I can't give it away, but at some point that will happen.
Yeah. As I was reading them, I found it that you know, when we read a novel, we are into it and we can't wait to go back to it, or we don't want to put it down. And in a short story, it's more like having a hot cup of cocoa and sitting with it,
mm-hmm.
and but yet still having that same level of absorption. So that means you have to have the same level of character development and plot details that give us a lot in a little way. And so I'm imagining that editing's a big deal when you're writing stories like this.
Well, I do revise quite a bit, but I want to say that what makes a story long on impact is the subtext. That short stories, we have so much going on underneath those words. And if that's not happening, then we don't have a strong short story. I say this to my students, that words have to do double and triple and quadruple duty. You know, it can describe a setting, but it's also pointing to deeper meaning. It's also somehow characterizing the character. All of those things are happening. And I love short stories for that reason. I love the fact that I can sit down. I'm talking about as a reader now. I love the fact I can sit down and just take it in, you know, and my mind can hold it. It doesn't make sense to me that somehow the short story is seen as a lesser art or a journeyman's kind of work on the way to the novel. I think we need both of we need both short and long fiction in the world. But what I would say is that short stories, we may be a little harder to read because we cannot zone out. When we read a novel, we can, I mean, I know I do, I can, you know, kind of, I can skip, I mean, not mentally, but I can take in pages and think I'm reading them, but I don't really take them in. Whereas in a short story, if you don't take in a page, you've lost a lot. So in a way, they're more demanding, I think, on the reader, and I hope in a good way. As I said, I love novels. I love short stories. I have to just say that we wouldn't have had the movie Brokeback Mountain without the short story Brokeback Mountain, and we wouldn't have had Breakfast at Tiffany's without the short story or The Birds. I mean, all of these things have turned into movies, and I'm referring to movies, but it's an important art, and I think it's going to continue to be important.
Well, in the reading of it, I think there's an intensity, like a concentration, that you can't really escape from. Yeah, you can't zone out from.
Exactly.
And sometimes I found in reading your book, and I'll mention the title again, it's World Gone Missing, and we're speaking with Lori Ann Doyle, its author. In completing a story,
mm-hmm.
I didn't want to move on to the next one almost because the mood is so strong and the emotional content of I would say all of the stories was one that I didn't want to just switch off or move on to. And I think maybe with short stories, many readers don't just plow through them
mm-hmm.
one after another because mm-hmm. You kind of have to savor it a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I'm like that. I think, you know, I became a lover of short stories before I started writing short stories. I was completely drawn in by Alice Munro. And then, of course, fiction is all about what if. It's all about what if. So there's one story that I actually have been criticized for in workshop, that it has a happy ending, which is Here I Am. It's a love story. And in a way, I mean, there's a shadow of something always hanging over. But I won't say what happens. But, you know, the love goes both ways.
So I thought that was your lightest story, and we should mention that in that story there the main character is a mortician, a female or a funeral director,
yes.
I guess would be the accurate way to put it.
I think it's actually the terms are interchangeable. I'm pretty sure, but yeah, and that was really fun to write. That was such a fun story. It was still a hard story because what is she working in? What's the milieu she's in? You know, she's in this milieu of missingness. You know, people who are there and suddenly no more. So that has affected her a lot and has affected her to become more flamboyant And then when I started, I actually do research my short stories, which sounds a little crazy, but I do. You know, when I started researching, like, what is the life of a mortician? What is the life of a funeral director? Evidently, they tend to be pretty out there people. And some people do hypothesize that it's because it's quiet where they work. And it's, you know, death is forever. So take advantage of life. And I think Lena is in Here I Am is really doing that in a way. But I think here's the other side. I think that's what short stories are all about. It's this incongruence. It's the loss and the gain right next to each other. It's the sorrow and the happiness bumping so close up to each other. So, yeah, but yet she has a really hard time with intimacy. And really that's what the story is about, is how's she going to handle this, you know?
Yet it's something she knows she's missing.
Yeah. Yes. She feels that emptiness. But it becomes clear to her when her ex comes, when an ex-boyfriend and an ex-husband comes back unexpectedly.
Yeah.
And that was fun to think about. Well, wow, what would happen?
Yeah. So you've mentioned the San Francisco Writers Grotto. Can you tell us what that is? Tell us what that's all about and your relationship with that.
Oh, the San Francisco Writers Grotto is a wonderful community. It's gone through a lot of descriptive phrases, co-working. Some people call it a co-op. You know, I think community is the best way to put it. It was started 21 years ago, which is a long time, by four men who said, well, we're writers, but writing is so isolating. Let's write together. So they rented like a Victorian, I think a flat in a Victorian house. It was Poe Bronstein and Ethan Waters and Ethan McCain, and I'm not remembering the fourth one. And they just realized that we're gonna leverage our work so much more profoundly if we're in community, because writing is necessarily an isolating or singular act, but the business of writing, you know, the finding of an agent, the networking, the figuring out who the best publicist is, having book parties, you know, knowing who the booksellers are, all of that is much better done in community. So I joined about 3 years ago. I revised a lot of World Gone Missing at the Writer's Grotto. So right now, just to catch people up, 21 years later, it's about 125 members. It's in South Park in San Francisco. It's the second floor. There's been, I think this is the fourth place that the grotto has been in. There's something wonderful because you go and write in your office and then you come out and have lunch in this big lunchroom. And that's also kind of keeps your spirit going. But there was something ineffable in the air. Like all these people had published books and I thought, well, gosh, I can publish a book too. And we actually had a focus group. And I gave people pizza and I said, you know, come and I'll give you pizza and drinks and we'll brainstorm, like, where can I submit this to? Now, none of the places that people suggested, you know, ended up being the publisher. But again, it gets you down the road and they just have good advice. You know, should I get an agent? Should I wait for an agent? And everyone said, try to get an agent, but don't let that hold you up. If you don't get an agent, just, you know, go with an indie press, which is what I ended up doing. And, you know, I love my press. It was a new press, and it's flourishing.
So you came to writing after another career, or you had a career and decided you really must honor your desire to write, and even went to an MFA program. Mm-hmm. Where did you go to an MFA?
I went to the University of San Francisco. I had a great experience. I loved it. I'd always been a closet poet, and I've published exactly one poem in my life. I've published much more fiction and nonfiction, but the poetry taught me about subtext. I think the poetry set me up really well for being a short story and really being a writer, because novels have a huge amount of subtext too, and I love that about novels. It's just different. But there was always the matter of a day job. I also have a master's in public health from Yale, and I worked a long time. I worked at Kaiser in my many years, and I was a health educator and trainer. I loved it. I was one of those writers who was trying to write on the side. And I realized I just couldn't do it. I mean, sometimes I could do it, but when you have a corporate job and it's very busy and you need to be available, and sometimes it would become the job that ate my brain. So I had to make some hard decisions. Thankfully, I want to honor my Kaiser colleagues. I was able to get a 20-hour-a-week job when I was in my MFA program. And then finally, I said to myself, I need to just say goodbye. I had saved up a lot of money because I knew that I wasn't going to make money instantly as a writer. So I saved up a lot of money, and then I just kind of left healthcare, and I started teaching. I love to teach, and teaching comes much more easily to me than writing. It just happens. Yeah, so I had a teaching job even before I finished my MFA. I was teaching freshman comp at UC Berkeley, which was great. But also, I mean, I say this to my students, you have to organize your life to allow you to write. And being a teacher of freshman comp did not allow me to write. So I switched and started teaching at UC Extension. And now that's where I teach. I teach creative writing at UC Extension at Berkeley, you know, UC Berkeley Extension, and also at the San Francisco Writer's Grotto. But my students are endlessly inspiring to me. I think they're just wonderful.
Well, I think that is a wonderful story, too, of just that we can continue to evolve and explore and manifest our desire.
Yes, yes.
You have to plan a little bit.
Yes, yes.
But
yes, I had to
have
a serious talk with my husband. Like, you know, it's going to be, it might be tight for a while. But, you know, he was very supportive. But I do want to say to people, if I'm an example of following your dream, so be it. I couldn't be happier. I mean, being a writer is the hardest thing I've ever done. It's way harder than my work anywhere in healthcare. It's just hard to reflect the truth of the human condition. That is hard. But it's what I want to do.
I think there are 13 stories in this book.
12.
12 stories. A dozen stories in World Gone Missing. Lorianne Doyle is talking with me. And Lori, I wonder if you would read a story. There's a short one, Next Door. I thought was a short story,
sure.
A radio-length story, and also I think does give a flavor for your storytelling.
Well, thanks. I'd love to read it. Yeah, so this is all of 650 words. One of my flashes. There are two in the collection. Next Door. She walked into the kitchen, crumpled to her knees, and died, her daughter said. Our houses have stood side by side for more than a century. The walls are so close I can reach out and almost touch her windowsill. We share a narrow driveway. Standing at the kitchen sink for the first time 16 years ago, I saw the face of the woman next door appear at her window in our mutual slice of morning sun. She was plucking out chin hairs. From upstairs, I watched her reposition pots of white cyclamen on her French porch, sop up rainwater with thick towels. At 10 every night, the bedroom light switched off. At 6 in the morning, the toilet flushed. Her name was Esther. She was tall and thin and wore hats, big beige bowls for gardening, tightly woven black straw for opera and church. If I stopped to say hello, she'd complain that the weeds from our side had spread, that maple leaves were littering her yard, her blue river stone and moss, grass-free front yard. The wrought iron fence surrounding it rose to sharp black points. My husband put in this fence, she'd told me more than once. My husband, you know, was the chief of staff at the hospital before he passed. So if you ever need any medical attention, let me know. I took to parking our car on her side, just so we'd have something else to talk about. 3 years ago, Esther phoned out of the blue. You like martinis? Because if you've got the olives, I've got the Bombay. My husband and I drank blue sapphires and watched the A's game on Esther's new 24-inch TV. Big, she bragged. Her house smelled like cat litter and cough syrup. That was fun, she said afterward, as we stood out on the front porch. But bring a light bulb next time, would you? I could use an extra. We laughed, but there was urgency in her voice, as if she wanted to make certain we'd be back. and soon. When our son was born, she gave him a silver cup with his name engraved across it. Every boy needs one, she said, with no further explanation. 6 months ago, I suddenly saw hands in Esther's bedroom window, pale arms reaching, but no head. Cars I didn't recognize parked in our driveway. A sister, one neighbor said. Then a nurse. Another nurse. Doors slammed. The toilet flushed at all hours. The last time I saw Esther, she stood inside her black fence. Hello, shoes, she said as I walked closer. She had piled stones in the corner of her front yard, only half burying the yellow-flowered sour grass that had sprung up. Her face was so wrinkled it looked scarred. When she asked me when her birthday was, I made something up. She smiled, waving to my feet as I left. 2 days after Esther died, a different daughter came to clean out the house. A son rode up in a white motorcycle, put the cat in a crate, and drove off. I watched cardboard boxes being carried down the steps, handmade pottery bowls, and flabby cushions. After the daughter left, we went through the pile left out on the sidewalk for pickup. When no one was looking, I took the Christmas present we had given Esther years before, a stainless steel cocktail shaker still in its red box, and an unraveling roll of fleur-de-lis shelf paper. 2 weeks ago, a couple with a baby due next month moved in. An upright piano sits on the front porch, and the bedroom light comes on and goes off whenever it wants. This morning, I caught the woman next door, the one I've never met, staring at me as the sun filled the glass of the window. I looked away, looked back, but still she was staring, as if my face, too, might suddenly go missing.
Laurie Ann Doyle reading next door from her collection, World Gone Missing. Well, thank you so much for visiting us up here today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Yes. That was my conversation with Laurie Ann Doyle. Her book is World Gone Missing. Earlier, we heard from Sarah Blake on her novel, The Guest Book. I thank you for listening, and I thank Sean Knight and Mark Prell for production assistance. Visit us online at norcalpublicmedia.org. Follow the radio links and subscribe to our podcast so you can listen to past shows anytime you want. I'm Suzanne Lang. It's a novel idea.